You're listening to a special edition of Midori House from Freeze Art Fair, first broadcast on the 10th of October, 2012, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to the second of our special editions of Midori House on Monocle 24, coming to you live from the Freeze Art Fair in Regent's Park, North London, with me, Robert Bound. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, I'll be getting a critical perspective on the fair from Time Out's art editor, Ossian Ward. We'll also hear the reaction of Amanda Sharp, co-founder of Freeze, to this year's opening day.
I haven't seen this energy in years. It's remarkable. You could smell it the minute the doors opened. It was a really happy surprise. I can't quite believe how energetic it feels in here. It's just brilliant. It's really, really exciting.
I'll be asking Tim Marlowe of the White Cube Gallery what he's got on display this year, and also hear what's catching the eye of collector Valeria Napoleoni. Plus, we'll be asking Charlotte Burns, art market editor for the Art newspaper, what's selling. All that, plus maybe a song or two too, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House, live from Freeze on Monocle 24. But first, let's cross back to our studios just down the road to get the latest news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
On the second day of public hearings into whether Saif al-Islam Gaddafi should face justice at home or at the International Criminal Court, Melinda Taylor, Gaddafi's defence legal adviser, who was detained in Libya for almost a month in June, told judges today that Gaddafi will be hanged if the case is given to Libyan authorities, as they are motivated by the desire for revenge.
Mr. Gaddafi is not a guinea pig. He is a person with rights. Although the government tried to diplomatically dance around the issue of the death penalty, let's be very clear, if convicted, Mr. Gaddafi will be hanged. The repeated manner in which the Libyan officials have referred to the fact that Mr. Gaddafi will receive the death penalty, if convicted, strongly suggests that this trial is not motivated by a desire for justice, but a desire for revenge.
The former IMF chief, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, who was disgraced by numerous rape allegations, spoke today about the Eurozone crisis at a forum in Seoul, making a comeback as an economics expert. He proposed that the worst solution to save the Eurozone was for Greece to exit the zone.
We have to avoid the wrong solutions. The wrong solution is this idea that Greece could get out. It may happen if nothing is done. At the end of the day, it may happen. But I think it's the worst solution. It's very bad for Greece. It's very bad for the rest of the Eurozone.
Family members of those killed in the Bali bombings a decade ago said it was desperately sad to look back on the 10 years they've spent without them. Friday will mark the 10th anniversary of the blast that ripped through two nightclubs, killing 202 people. NATO defence ministers have wrapped up a two-day meeting today, saying that the planned withdrawal of combat forces from Afghanistan was not being speeded up. The NATO General Secretary, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, said he had full confidence that Afghan forces would be capable of taking the lead role in security operations when the NATO mission enters a new phase of providing support and training in 2014.
The security situation, though there are still challenges, is improving. And the capability of the Afghan security forces is also improving. And based on that, I feel confident that the Afghan security forces will be able to take full responsibility by the end of 2014.
Here, Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron has today rallied the party faithful at the Conservative Party conference, telling them that Britain is on the rise, but that it was sink or swim time for the country. He promised to support entrepreneurs and cut welfare bills, and acknowledged that bringing down the deficit was taking longer than previously thought, but ended his speech on a positive note.
Now, I know that you are asking whether our plan is working. And here's the truth. The damage was worse than we thought, and it's taking longer than we hoped. Let us get Britain on the rise. Deficit paid down, tough decisions taken, growth fired up, aspiration backed all the way. We know what it takes to win in the tough world of today, to win for all our people, to win for Britain. So let us get out there and do it.
And finally, German police have today said that a 14-year-old German teenager took his mother's jewellery worth €3,000 and pawned it for €300 to finance two trips to a brothel for himself and a friend. The teenager's mother is pressing charges of theft against her son, who admitted he pawned the jewellery to pay for the prostitutes. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. It is 5 minutes past 6 p.m. here in London. You're listening to a very special edition of Midori House on Monocle 24. We're coming to you live from the Frieze Art Fair in London. I can't wait to get started.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se om Monocle 24.
Shandai, Efrog Newydd, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Oh, it couldn't be any more Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House. Yesterday we broadcasted live from Frieze Masters, and today we're live from Frieze London, that this year celebrates its 10th birthday. Without further ado, let us welcome our first guest with a manly embrace. Ossian Ward is art editor of Time Out London. He's a Frieze veteran. He's got a trained eye, and today, a husky voice for the radio. Ossian, welcome to the show.
Good evening. Yeah, sorry about that. It's overexertion this week sort of takes it out of you. There's lots of parties and deals to be done, so I feel Wednesday?
Yeah, it's only Wednesday.
Yeah, I'm not doing
You've
very
well.
You've
got to push on through.
Yeah,
people were saying yesterday that if you can make it to Saturday unscathed, then you're doing very well.
Well, the Saturday, if you haven't collapsed, you know. I did actually collapse 1 year on the Saturday with an inner ear infection, which was like the worst thing I've ever had.
But sounds like a euphemism for something.
Well, no, it was pretty nasty, but there is always some kind of lurgy or something going around the tent as well, so I try and avoid that. But there may be too many drinks as well involved, I'm not sure.
Well, I'm going to segue neatly into a phrase called Frieze fever. That might be a complaint you might pick up during these few days of the art fair in London. Is there Frieze fever still? We're celebrating its 10th birthday this year. There seems to be a lot of energy in the room. I'm sure our listeners can hear the hubbub around us of deals being done and people sipping champagne and all.
I don't know if anyone's kind of popping the corks just yet. I know it's their 10th edition, but they started in 2003, so there's a bit of confusion as to whether next year is their 10th birthday.
It's a bit like the millennium, isn't
like
it?
When is it? 2013 or 2012? Yeah. So, but 10 fairs, you know, obviously it's become a staple. It's become the moment at which London puts its best shows on. You know, everyone puts their best clothes on as well for autumn. It's kind of changed our calendar to revolve around this October slot. So it's changed a lot of things in London for the better, I have to say. You know, there've been a few tough years in the financial market. So, you know, I don't know how well the fair does. You know, the dealers all seem happy, but you never know until it's all wrapped up.
I guess so. And I mean, I wonder also how public Frieze are about how good business is. I guess there are ways of massaging things.
Absolutely.
Generally, people seem to always people seem to come back.
You know when things are bad, when all the dealers really want to talk to you. They've got loads of time on their hands. You're like, do you really need to talk to me? Or are you just killing time because there's no one to give you a big check? So I always know when it's bad, when everyone's too friendly. You know, when everyone's kind of like, oh, come sit down, have a chat. I think there must be something wrong here.
I know it's early days. We're sort of 6 o'clock on the Wednesday. I guess it's the opening day for press, VIPs and collectors. Have many gallerists spoken to you, or have you been regarded with a haughty stare?
I haven't seen as much as I'd like to. I've seen about half of it, so my first impressions are, I know it sounds obvious, but there's a lot of work on the walls. Now, what I mean by that is that it's portable, it's small stuff, it's not big scale, it's not adventurous, there's nothing terribly exciting or new to say, because everyone's kind of hedging their bets, thinking, you know, I'll bring some small things, I'll bring some things that will sell, things that go on the walls, nothing too adventurous, won't go too crazy this year. I think everyone's kind of still in that battening down the hatches mode.
There's an idea that when times are tough, or there's a kind of premonition perhaps that things might be tough at the fair,
that you basically are looking to for people to fill the space over the mantelpiece rather than some crazy monstrous sculpture that they have to build a barn to put it in.
Yeah, right? And I think, you know, there's a time and a place for those things, but given that you have to, you know, bet your whole stand on selling out or selling this one piece, you're much better off saying, oh, if I sell five small pieces, then I'll have broken even or I'll have made my money back and made some profit. Whereas if you're banking on this one thing to sell, then you know that's risky. That's kind of boom time risk. But then, you know, the stands at the fair that seem to attract the most attention, the one that's won a prize, you know, they're the ones that take a risk, that have single artist presentation or something risky or something new. Otherwise, it's kind of like shopping time, you know, at the supermarket. Here's your rack of nice, tasteful photographs. Here's some other stuff, you know.
And I wanted to ask you about one of the things that sort of has made people feel a little bit nervous. We were talking about this earlier before we switched on the mics, was about galleries, especially American galleries, New York galleries, coming in their droves to London, which is a great thing for London. It's a vote of confidence for London and the economy of London, at least the art economy of London. I wanted to ask you about that, to explore that a bit further, because that presumably makes a difference to the dynamic of an art fair in London and the London galleries that exhibit here too.
Well, as I was saying, basically this thing is on for the weekend, you know, and then it packs up and goes home. But there's quite a few big American galleries that have moved here in the last couple of weeks, and they're showing a major commitment to London. So Pace Gallery, Michael Werner Gallery, David Zwerner Gallery, they're all big names. It's a bit worrying for the London market because, you know, they are heavyweights in their field and they bring with them their own artists and they bring with them, you know, same artists that we have here. So the temptation is that, you know, it's going to put a squeeze on the galleries that are already here. But I'm tempted to see it as a much more positive thing, actually, that, you know, this is a sign that London is definitively one of the centres of the art market. So, you know, no matter what the dealers will say, oh, it's getting a bit crowded, for us, you know, it's great to have them here. It's great to have access to, you know, new artists. So David Zwerner opened this very elegant Mayfair space with a Luke Toymans show, you know, very sort of pared back, elegant painting. You know, it was almost like a sort of sneak attack. You know, the paintings are very sort of pale, but actually, you know, this is a sign of strength. This is like, we've got Luke Toymans, we can show him. And, you know, he's a big, big cheese artist. So if you think I'm croaky, when he turned up after his opening night and he was rather drunk still, as he admitted in the morning, and he kind of had this rambling speech about how all us Londoners were half-hearted Europeans, we hadn't made the leap into the euro. And I was thinking to myself, he was just rambling, but it was very entertaining. But then that's really why all these galleries are here, because we're not in the euro, we're not part of the crumbling eurozone. Actually, London still does have a kind of strong economy, and I think, you know, apart from it just being a global destination, I think that people are still kind of banking on us to be able to sort of uphold this position for years to come. They're not worried about us kind of slipping down, you know, into some sort of monetary doom and gloom just yet. So there must be something behind all these galleries wanting to come here. You know, they've been toes in the water for a few years now, but it seems to be that London is the place after New York that they all want to be.
And one of the reasons for that is Frieze. We can't really underestimate the fact that 10 years of this tent turning from a tent to a cathedral almost in 10 years, right, makes a big, big difference, and presumably lays a lot of the foundations for these galleries to come here and know that they've got a captive audience of people, of buyers, of people that at least fly through London or have a base in London.
Yeah, I mean,
it's a nice offshore bank accounts possibly available.
Yeah, I mean, I'm no futurist or I'm no sort of doom and gloom merchant, but
can we get some t-shirts printed with that on?
It is still a tent, you know. Yeah. So it might move. It's moved to New York, where they started in New York this year. Who knows whether we're still going to be all being bullish about London in 10 years' time. Yeah. We're all going to be sat in Hong Kong or Shanghai going, yeah, this is the centre of the art market, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So for us to say it's all, you know, great here, it is also to ignore the fact that a lot of these galleries are moving to Hong Kong, they're moving to Rio, to Sao Paulo. You know, everyone's looking for the next thing. London is a sure thing, yeah, but, you know, it's a temporary tent. We might not still be here. The tent might have moved on, you know. Might be in Marrakesh in 10 years' time.
If it's a blustery day, you never know what might happen, right?
Yeah, well, you know, it looks pretty secure, but I haven't noticed the teething problems of the first years, like birds flying in and, you know, leaves.
I thought that was an installation piece.
No, they've conquered all of that. It was a bit, there's still trees here, you know, they have to build the tent around,
around some of the trees, which is rather nice.
Because they're not allowed to, obviously not allowed to chop them down. And they struggled for years thinking, oh, we can't grow the tent, we need more galleries. And they were like, why don't you just put a hole around the trees? And they were like, oh, yeah,
that's genius.
Great. And they could make it bigger. And now, obviously, they've found another place down the, around the park for Freeze Masters. There, sounds like me this morning.
Yeah, throaty. Sounds like Luke Toymans after a good night out. Yeah. Got one final question for you. We mentioned this. We'll speak to this later. We're going to have Charlotte Burns on from the Art Newspaper on later on. We were talking about the idea of artist representation. This is something that gets weird, isn't it? If you're a if you're an artist and you signed up with a London gallery because you're a British artist, and then you have an LA gallery, and then that LA gallery moves to London, what happens to you as an artist? A bit like someone having a record deal with two separate record labels, isn't it?
It is that record deal analogy, but the other way to think about it is like you're in with a small indie label that does your first album, and you do okay, but actually you outgrow your label really quickly, so suddenly it's like big pressure from the majors. And when a major comes in and says, here's $500,000, sign up with me, you're not going to say no. When the other guy's saying, oh, I'll pay you next week, honest, you know, the invoice is in the mail kind of thing. So the temptation's there with the big money. So, you know, that's going to happen. The clash is, it does get very messy when there's a gallery, you know, someone like Peter Doig, who traditionally has been with a British gallery, suddenly turning up with a foreign gallery and showing with them, that gets kind of complicated and a bit messy. But maybe Charlotte Burns will tell you a bit more about that.
She might be able to shine a light on it.
Yeah, I'm just here for the drink.
She's got her art torch in her handbag. I've seen it. For the time being, Ossian Ward, art editor of London's Time Out. Thank you very much.
Cheers, thanks
for very much joining us on Midori House. We'll be back in a sec to speak to Amanda Sharp.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest episode, we hit Singapore for the annual World Architecture Festival Awards. Leaving aside Sakertort and Schnitzel, we ask what a new souvenir for 21st century Vienna might look like. And we talk ugly with author and critic Stephen Bailey.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
It's 6:18 p.m. here in London, and you're listening to Midori House, coming to you live from the Frieze Art Fair, and I'm Robert Bound. And as I was wandering around the fair earlier, I met up with Frieze founder Amanda Sharp to get her take on this year's event and the exponential growth of the Frieze project.
We launched Fair in New York in May.
Yeah.
Now we've got, you know, our old friend, the Contemporary Fair, that we're sitting in, and Masters up on the north side of the park. I don't know, it hasn't felt that difficult, to be honest.
Have you celebrated, you had 10 candles to blow out on Frieze's birthday cake this year.
Yeah.
In what style did you do that?
I opened my Masters Fair with Matthew and Victoria.
Hooray.
That was a big celebration. We kind of went on some time travel, I think, that was what we did.
And, having been in Masters yesterday, this sort of calm before the storm, coming in here again feels like a very different beast. Is that something that you've kind of tried to achieve, or is achieved by the vibe of the paintings and the works in those two separate spaces?
I think it is achieved by the different environments, actually. I don't know how we would affect it beyond the architecture and the content. I mean, I think that with Masters, oddly enough, it's things like having fabric walls, plush carpet, and work that people stand in front of in awe and sort of silence, because they can't quite believe that they're seeing a Byzantine head opposite an Avedon photograph next to an Eve Klein from the 60s. You know, it's quite an unusual juxtaposition within an environment.
Everyone's shoe leather. is very expensive and soft as well.
Of course, yes. Very true.
They wouldn't have it any other way at Masters, but bring it back to Frieze contemporary, Frieze London it's called now.
It is. It's called, Frieze London. Yeah, and we now have Frieze New York, Frieze London and Frieze Masters.
It's a triple bill of shame. And this year, do people feel, walking around, I see lots of smiling gallerists, people bouncing off the walls, or is there a sort of slow burn effect this year for sales and for optimism?
I haven't seen this energy in years. It's remarkable. You could smell it the minute the doors opened. It was a really happy surprise. I can't quite believe how energetic it feels in here. It's just brilliant. It's really, really exciting.
And we were talking earlier about some of these big American galleries coming over to London this year, setting up shop. And obviously that adds a bit of an impetus to the fair, even though they've been showing with you guys for 10 years probably before. Does that sort of change the nature of things? Does that sort of put the London galleries on their toes a bit, do you think?
We'll just have to see how it changes the ecology. Time will tell. But I'm sure that it ups the game for everyone. You know, if you've got someone on your street who renovates their house, you start looking around and thinking, oh, maybe I need a touch of paint too. So, yes, I can see that it will alter the city to some degree, absolutely.
Yeah. Maybe a few London galleries with their overalls on doing some repairs.
You know, they do a pretty good job already.
And have you made any changes to the space this year? I think we talked last year and you'd widened the aisles, you'd kind of tried to make it a little bit more chilled. It does get sometimes quite busy and there's a lot of stuff to see. You need to stand back to see some of it. Have you made any sort of architectural design changes to the space this year?
Not as many. They're probably imperceptible, but I think they affect people's experience. So, for example, when we launched our fair in May in New York, everyone kept talking to us about how amazing the light was and how it felt so beautiful in there. So we thought, well, I guess those lights are better than the lights in London. So we brought over our New York lights. We strengthened the floor. We put in a pizza oven. I mean, sort of small things that add up, basically.
This is nice. We need to go and check out the pizza oven, I think, actually. There is a set, yeah, I feel like there's what they do in casinos where they have the lights on a certain thing and they pump oxygen. You're not pumping oxygen here to keep everyone going, are you? Because there's a long walk around Frieze these days.
No, we do. We pump oxygen in here.
No, I thought it was. I wonder why we
actually do pump fresh air into this fair. I'm not messing with you.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Where does it come in?
Can you see the heating ducts? In the ceiling.
Now I wonder why everyone feels so fresh, everyone's so perky. Everyone's standing up straight for sort of 9 hours a day here.
Yes, exactly. And they want to look smiley and friendly so that people will come up to them and talk to them and ask them questions about their art.
And just finally, how do you measure the mark of the success of Frieze this year? There's sort of been lots of people talking about it, lots of sort of queues will be forming tomorrow for opening day, for the public day. I know obviously your gallerists, some of them are beaming from ear to ear, but what makes it so special for you? What are the key things that kind of make you tick the box of happy Frieze, happy 10th birthday Frieze?
Well, ultimately it's going to be whether or not the galleries are happy, whether the collectors are happy, and whether the general public, when they come in on the open days, actually enjoy it as an experience. So you can kind of figure that out, to be honest, just by standing in the middle of the fair and looking around. It's not that complicated to tell. I know today already that we've got 2 out of 3, so let's see how it goes tomorrow.
Amanda, thank you for bringing us pizza, fresh air and the 10th year of Frieze.
That's a pleasure. I should also mention the ice cream.
And that was Frieze co-founder Amanda Sharp talking to me earlier. I sounded a bit like a chipmunk on that. I've no idea why. Maybe it was it played slightly too fast? I don't know. You are tuned in to Midori House live on Monocle 24. Coming to you from Frieze. We'll be back with White Cube's Tim Marlowe in a second. It is 6:24 p.m. and we're coming to you at Midori House live from the Frieze Art Fair. And one stand that everyone looks to for a lead each year at Frieze is White Cube, home of many a marquee name. And I'm delighted to say that the August Gallery's August Director of Exhibitions, Tim Marlowe, joins me now at Midori House. Tim, welcome to the show.
Yeah, I think you mean the August Gallery, not the August.
I put August in twice. It must have been a mistake on the script. I don't know what happened. Sorry.
Can I also say that you're not sounding like a chipmunk now?
There's real
gravitas now.
This is gravitas.
Yeah.
I'm relaxing into it. There was a strange pre-recorded interview with Amanda Sharp. I'm sure I didn't sound like that. It sounded like Jules Holland introducing a band. and hello, here's the white stripes. It sounded a bit like that. Anyway.
I think you should do that. I think you should wander around the booth. And now,
everyone following me around with a very long wire. Tim, welcome to the show. Again, we'll start.
It's a pleasure.
We're going to crack on. We're going to start again. We're going to do it. Now, it's we've all sort of been sort of slightly nursing hangovers, been wandering around. This is a great week when business and pleasure mix. After 10 years of Frieze, have you got the mix right?
I think probably so. I mean, I tell you, the thing that strikes me is the fact that Frieze hit the ground running with great momentum, and pretty well that momentum's continued. And I think they have. I mean, I make no bones about the fact. I think Matthew and Amanda should be knighted and damed. They should also be taken into a corner and given a dusting over for ruining our Octobers. But I think their strategy and their vision has been really smart. And of course, I know you've been talking about it because you were broadcasting live yesterday, but I think Frieze Masters is very smart. I mean, it's great marketing. It's a great expansion. Most art fairs look to youth and emerging markets. They've gone the other way. So the future is the past, or is it the past is the future? Anyway, that's now the new momentum.
I'm going to write it down, and then by the end of it, I'll have worked it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then how does it feel? It feels strange coming from broadcasting from Frieze Masters yesterday, enjoying the fair yesterday, and then suddenly coming into here. It does really feel very different. It feels brighter. It's definitely louder. We can hear that on our microphones. It's got a very, very different... This feels more contemporary than it used to feel because Masters is up the park, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other great thing about Masters. It makes this fair seem even more buzzy and energetic. Although I love the Masters because it's like going back to a library and rather quietly wandering around grey carpets... A kind of quality, you know, it's like being an old-fashioned connoisseurial art historian. And there's quite a lot of, well, I think I could say this. I think potentially there's a bit of dubious stuff up there. I mean, I think that, you know, Iraqi war loot and all the rest of it, I think people should start looking. Because, I mean, the stuff that seems to have been ripped off major buildings that are for sale there. So there's something for the detectives as well.
I was walking around trying not to do too many impersonations of these certain gargoyles that we were talking about extensively on yesterday's show as well.
I couldn't find it. They're from the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Strasbourg, but were they made for the cathedral and never put up, or were they originally on the cathedral? Because if so, how did they come to be in this art fair?
This is kind of like stealing apples off a tree or waiting them to fall down, isn't it? I wonder whether, honest Gav, they were on the ground when I saw them. That's why one of the paws has been ripped off the dog, right?
The low-hanging fruit. Yeah, they were exactly. Clearly the ones just by the door.
Exactly. But as I say, walking into this fair today, it does seem extra bright, extra exuberant. I guess it's just louder and the crowd is younger. In terms of White Cube's place, very much always in the centre of things at Frieze. Are we early enough on in the day or late enough on in the day, this first opening sort of VIP day, to put a thermometer in the mouth of the White Cube?
Well, yeah, you know, the most successful art fair strategy is to make sure that you know which of your major clients are coming and you let them know the kind of work you intend to show. And so, and transparencies are sent out. So if you're really smart and, you know, a certain amount of luck as well, you can do a lot of serious business in the first 2 hours. It's not to say if you don't, the fair is not going to be a success, but so we're pretty well sold out. Because the right works were placed for the right kind of collectors. But of course, you know, there's more work can be put up. I tell you the thing that struck me about this. I mean, you're saying the brightness and the kind of energy, and that's true. But every art fair has a kind of core of people that seem to go to most of them, or certainly yeah. The big ones. And yet each art fair has its own kind of identity too in terms of the audience. It's usually regional. So in Miami, it's American and South American. In Hong Kong, there's a lot of Australasians and Asians yeah. there as well. And obviously Basel is the most international blue chip. But London, I think we get the most diverse global audiences here. I mean, today, opening day, I've spoken to museum directors, collectors, artists from 5 different continents. That's pretty wide-ranging.
Yeah. How many continents are there?
7, I think.
Are there?
Yeah.
That's another thing I'm going to have to write down. We're going to do it. We're going to do facts and Tim Marlowe's facts and stats at the end of the show.
Really, yes. And you're going to touch on and say, who did you speak to from Antarctica? The answer was no one.
Exactly. And Mr. Penguin from Antarctica. And I want to ask, how do you choose the balance of what you're going to show in the gallery? I mean, the stuff that you know... You know, your big name artist that you know people are always very interested in and breaking new stuff in. How do you get that balance? How do you decide year to year?
I mean, there's always the thought of could you make it more project-based? Could you do solo artist presentations, which occasionally we've done, although not at Frieze, but we have done, for example, Jake and Dinas Chapman did an extraordinary project where they painted people's portraits that became an installation that was in their Take Liverpool show. I think our strategy tends to be we show the range of art that we and artists that we work with, and we want to showcase that, and you know what the breadth of what the gallery is and who it works for. I think that sometimes, and I'm not being critical, I like it when galleries are you know, imaginative and experimental, but I think it's better sometimes not to overblur the distinction. Exhibitions for us are fundamentally not commercial first and foremost. It's giving the artist a chance of space to do something like a punctuation point or to mark a career. And the commercial activity can follow, it can happen in back rooms, or it can be generated as a consequence of what's being done. It's not to say you don't sell from exhibitions, it's not to say you don't sell whole exhibitions, but the primary motivation is give the artist the space, be an artist-led gallery, serve their needs. Art fairs, I think, are much better if you're simply looking smartly at strategically placing work and trying to expand your client base and so on, and just to be honest about that. And I think it's better not to try and pretend that you've curated your space over much. So, you know, sometimes you could say that a lot of galleries seem to have the usual suspects. There are certain artists, and I'm not telling you which ones of ours, but there are certain artists that don't want to be in art fairs. There are others that only want secondary market. You know, you have to, so one has to be, I suppose, careful. You have to think about what you've done in years gone by. There's no point just having exactly the same number of artists. But, you know, it's not rocket science. It's you want an interesting balance, and that's what you get, and you want a bit of pizzazz.
And just before we go to the news, very briefly, you've been doing this and you've been on both sides of the microphone, obviously, Tim, as well, broadcasting and being part of the gallery here. Do you still get a sort of nervous buzz out of coming here when the VIPs hurdle over the stalls to come and buy your wares? Do you still get a thrill?
I get a thrill. I always come here, and I particularly to Frieze, because it's the beginning of that, you know, that autumn season. I always come here slightly, oh, crikey, right, here we go again, deep breath, a bit trepidatious, not so much nervous, but and then, of course, as soon as the fair opens and everyone comes in, then the energy levels start to go. So, yeah, I'm starting to buzz now, and that happens all the time. I'm more excited, by the way, about having seen Michael Ballack wandering around here, because I think that the great cultural barrier that we need to go through is getting more major professional footballers collecting art, and apparently he does, so maybe this is a trend.
But not making it.
Not making it.
Only on the pitch.
Chilida made sculpture, by the way, and he was a semi-professional footballer, but that's another story.
Footballers' galleries, it's a big new story. For the time being, the Five Continental, Tim Marlowe from White Cube, thank you very much for joining us. In the next half hour of the show, we'll be joined by Charlotte Burns, art market editor of the Art newspaper. We'll ask collector Valeria Napoleoni what's caught her eye, and we'll see what's on offer at this year's Frieze project. And here with the news headlines is Jonathan Wheatley.
Thank you very much. On the second day of public hearings into whether Saif al-Islam Gaddafi should face justice at home or at the International Criminal Court, his defence legal adviser has told judges today that he will be hanged if the case is given to Libyan authorities. The former IMF chief, Dominic Strauss-Kahn, who was disgraced by numerous rape allegations, spoke today about the Eurozone crisis at a forum in Seoul, making a comeback as an economic expert. He proposed that the worst solution to save the Eurozone was for Greece to exit the zone. Family members of those killed in the Bali bombs a decade ago said it was desperately sad to look back on the 10 years they spent without them. Friday will mark the 10th anniversary of the blast that ripped through two nightclubs, killing 202 people. NATO defence ministers have wrapped up a two-day meeting today, saying that the planned withdrawal of combat forces from Afghanistan was not being speeded up. And here, Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron has said that Britain is on the rise, but that it was sink or swim time for the country. He acknowledged that bringing down the deficit was taking longer than previously thought. And for the moment, those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
All right, thanks, Jonathan. I'm Robert Bound. This is Midori House. We're coming to you live from the Frieze Art Fair. And of course, that means you're tuned in to Monocle 24. Now, every day at Frieze, the art newspaper publishes a free daily edition. What a lot of work to gauge the sales and gossip from the aisles of the art fair. Their crack team of reporters and editors are out and about around the fair and the parties to get a handle on who's doing what, to whom, and for how much. The queen of them all, perhaps the princess, is art market editor of the art newspaper, Charlotte Burns. And luckily for us, she joins us on the show live now. Charlotte, welcome.
Too kind, thank you very much.
We can be the queen or the princess. I thought queen might be sort of aging you slightly.
Aging, I agree.
Princess,
right? Let's go with
princess.
Right?
Princess. Yeah,
go with princess. Much better, thanks.
Now, you've come with a sort of a freshly sharpened set of pencils, 10 notebooks, and a dictaphone, you've come to gather all the goods on the Frieze Art Fair, as usual. What might you be writing about? What did you write about today? What might you be writing about tomorrow? What's the buzz?
Well, we've been looking at issues of artist representation, which Ossian touched upon in his interview with you guys, and the kind of shifting geographical territories of dealers means that the gentleman handshake deals of the art world are sort of shifting. We've been looking at Frieze 10 years on.
This is, we were saying to us, you know, this is quite a political thing. This is kind of like cutting yourself in half for a bit of commercial, for commercial reasons as an artist.
Yeah, and I think the art world's one of the more unlegislated industries in the world, and nothing really runs on contract. Galleries in general don't have contracts with their artists, so it's easy to tear up the rule book because it's never really been written down. So now that galleries are moving more and more into new geographical terrains, the unspoken and visible line of behaviour, which was that if you were a US gallery, you tried not to step on the toes of your European counterparts, is shifting as the art world becomes more global.
And this is kind of, a lot of people kind of come around, this is one of the sort of subtleties, one of the little shifts in the sand, that people that come and buy one or two things or look around or come for the free booze at the end of the day, they don't see. But this is quite a big deal, isn't it? Because there is quite a lot of, there's a lot of politics behind this. What does it sort of mean? It probably means more sales or more money for an artist, but do galleries sort of really fall out over this sort of thing?
Galleries on the surface say that things are fine, they can be philosophical, but of course there's huge competition. As the art market has become slightly more conservative, there's less betting on young, up-and-coming, emerging artists. So if you represent an artist who makes 6 to 7 figure sales regularly, for example, Anselm Kiefer, this week is opening Tadeusz Ropak's huge new space in Paris with new works, and is also opening in Paris with Gagosian in his huge new space with new works, and also opened White Cube's new space in Hong Kong in May with new works. So if you're Kiefer, you're probably a big enough artist that you can do what you like. If you're an emerging artist, it might be more difficult.
And you're basically also, if you're Kiefer, you're getting paid a lot of overtime.
You're getting paid a lot of overtime. Maybe it's not a branded thing for the... maybe it's not a bad thing for the market, which seems to lean more towards brands these days. But for the arts, it's perhaps a different story.
And one of the other things, of course, that you write about, running around from stand to stand, as there's a lot of... The headline on tomorrow's newspaper is often a sales-related story. There's a few big works around the fair that people will have their eye on, that galleries will have taken a risk to bring here because it takes up a lot of, I guess, square meterage of their space. And what might be tickling people's interest tomorrow?
Well, everybody's talking, of course, about the opening of Frieze Masters. The Frieze brand has grown ginormously in the last 10 years. It was... it's a word.
Ginormous.
It's become ginormous.
I'm getting such a long list of facts to have to check at the end of the show here. Ginormously.
Right. And it started as a kind of will it work event in 2003. The headlines were, you know, the question is whether this will last in London. And we reported sales of things going for £150,000. The prices have gone up, the art world's got bigger, and the Frieze brand has had to become more competitive as art fairs have become more the norm. So Frieze is opening its new, very classy Frieze Masters at the other end of the park, bringing in medieval art, modern art, and everything other than cutting-edge contemporary. And gargoyles. Huge gargoyles at Sandfog.
I wanted to ask you, it's a strange thing we see. This has become the norm for us journalists and obviously all the gallerists. There is a sense, in a way, that people feel that the place that they probably see art, if they go to a gallery once a year, other than it being a museum, is probably an art fair. I mean, Frieze is hugely popular. The Armory was always popular. Basel was popular in Switzerland. I mean, these things kind of... This seems to be the way that people look at art these days and buy it. I think galleries maybe can take bigger risks, perhaps, with the shows that they put on and make them maybe less saleable because they know that they can make up... They can make ends meet when they come to an art fair. Is there any flight in that fancy? I mean, it seems like an amazing way that people flock to these things to buy or not to buy.
I think it changes the dynamic of the art world because traditionally you would go and see shows in galleries. Like you say, that's the gallery model's now in decline. because people travel more and more to art fairs, curators. If you're a curator in a museum that's budget's been strapped through the recession, it makes more sense for you to fly to Basel, look at everything there in one fell swoop rather than go on a grand tour of Europe, because your museum frankly won't have the time or the money to send you. So it changes the way you see things. It would be nice to see single artist shows, but it's a bigger risk, so galleries tend to bring a kind of hodgepodge. You know, this is what we are about, this is who we represent. And of course they're under pressure to actually get the supply, because if they're doing, I don't know, an art fair a month, like some of the major dealers are, then where is all the work coming from?
People are making it in their garages.
That's what I heard. Yeah. Not in New York, they don't have garages there.
I'm going to bring some next time. And before we go, Charlotte, give us a little barometer. What's the buzz? Does this feel like a good year? There's lots of people walking around here smiling. As we say, I think the champagne corks have started to fly. Does this feel like it's a good year? Do you feel it in your gut from experience the last few years?
I think that it's a good year in the fact that people are excited about the new Frieze Masters. People always like something new. The auctions, it's the beginning of the season. There was a summer off. The art world tends to come back, and Frieze punctuates the kind of back-to-school feeling. So it feels good. It's different. There's more work. There's something to talk about. We're heading into the huge November sales in New York. There's a lot of great material. So it seems that the top end of the art market will continue its success story while the rest of the economy flounders.
There's a political answer, I feel, Charlotte Burns.
Oh, well, thanks, Rob. It was accidental.
Charlotte Burns, art editor, art market editor for the Art Newspaper. Thank you very much for joining me. Princess, not queen, I hasten to add.
Thank you.
And before we hear any more from the fair, I think it's time to play a song that reflects what I feel when I wander around Frieze. Magical Mystery Tour by the Beatles. Coming to take you away, it's the Magical Mystery Tour, that is the Beatles, but it could be performed by, I think, any of the artists exhibiting here at Frieze London this year. You are listening to Midori House, coming to you live from Frieze. We'll be back in a minute with a very, very interesting, lovely collector. Stay tuned.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and, again, how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time.
And this show is called Midori House. I'm called Robert Bound. You are listening to a radio station called Monocle 24. We are broadcasting live from the Frieze Art Fair in London. It's 6:44 p.m. Here on the opening day of the fair, many a collector can be seen stalking the wide, whitewashed aisles, keen to spot something which causes the heart to flutter and maybe their inner investor to do some basic arithmetic too. Valeria Napoleoni is one of our very favourites, one of the most astute, certainly the most stylish. I spoke to her earlier about her strategy, her shopping list and her heels.
Now, first things first, we've got to talk about your outfit. We've got to talk about the height of your heels. You've done a lot of walking today. How are your feet?
I feel fine. I'm used to it. I thought to myself, can I walk 7 hours or 8 hours in this?
Yeah.
And so far so good.
You can run a marathon in them. This is a sort of satin, what are we going to call it? It's a sort of satin wedge.
Wedge heels, satin, platform. Open toes.
That's very nice.
You can describe.
And with a pair of green tights, sort of Kelly green tights.
Yes.
Actually, these are the sort of colours of Aston Villa Football Club for our English listeners.
Fantastic.
Anyway, so that's the art out the way. Now let's talk about something.
How do you relate to it?
And how much of walking have you done today? I know that you...
Too much talking and not enough walking.
Really?
Too much talking. Yeah, because it's about saying hello and greeting people, and it's fantastic. I love it, but it's exhausting as well sometimes.
When you sort of wander about, do you have to have a strategy of which booths you go to? Do you get tipped off in advance about particularly interesting things that might be up your street?
Yeah, I mean, I get people letting me know what they're taking, knowing that I'm following a specific artist, so I see images, I sometimes they hold pieces for me until I come here and I see them. I don't have a specific strategy. Actually, I come here, no plan, no map. I lose my map constantly, and I have to go back and pick another one. And so, but if I have one or two things to see, I know that I'm going to go in one or two things, but no plan whatsoever.
And in terms of your collection and coming every year to this and to other fairs and collecting things, are you always looking to the future, or can you be quite impulsive? Or do you trust your taste enough to be able to be impulsive?
You mean specifically at the fair, or in general?
I mean generally buying, but I mean looking around today.
I can be really, you know, very spontaneous when I know the artist.
Right.
I know if I like something or not by gut feeling. If something engages with me, yes. But then I need to read, I need to see the artist, I need to do a lot of research behind that. So it takes time. Affairs can function very well if I know the artist already and there is something that is coming up, at the fair that comes out, at the fair that I discover, a piece that I didn't know about. And then I go for it because I've done my homework already.
Yeah. That's quite interesting, I think, for people to know. There's a lot of impulse involved in it, but then you have to do your homework afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I don't want to take away this impulsive, you know, attitude and very spontaneity from my collecting, because it's not calculation. It's totally my reaction, physical reaction, actually, my heart beating to the work. So that has to be there. If you think too much, it means that it's not there, but it's in here. So for me, it doesn't really, it's in your mind more, in your rationality more. When I don't really know why I should get this artist, probably that's the moment when I say this, because it's my physical reaction, my emotions. And so then I go for it. You know, after 15 years collecting, you know yourself and you know what you look for when you are in front of an artwork as a collector. And I look for specific type of reactions from myself. Excitement. When you are in love, or I don't know, when your heart beats, and it is actually that type of reaction.
And before we go, Valeria, I wanted to ask you how it works when you come to a fair, and people want to talk to you. You want to look at some paintings. You want to look at some pieces. Have you perfected the art of the 30-second conversation?
No. Oh gosh. But that's, you know, because I don't want to be rude, and And sometimes I'm genuinely really engaged in the conversation, I cannot stop. So this is my sister, says, Valeria, come on, it's time to go.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? It is a proper big social occasion.
Yeah.
I think it's underrated as that. There's obviously a lot of parties every night and different openings, and people in the auction houses have their big sales now in October in London. But it is an underrated big social occasion. For a certain type of person, this is going down the pub. This
absolutely,
is, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, especially for new buyers, newcomers, I think they never expect to have all this sort of social reality around it. And I think it can fascinate people. People can be fascinated by this lifestyle that is behind all this collecting activity. I'm focused on my work. I love it. I love social. I love sharing with my friends at dinners and stuff. But you have to keep focused. And the most important thing is the art. And my collection and my engagement with the artist, so never lose track of that.
And that was collector extraordinaire Valeria Napoleoni, and this is Midori House. Which station is it on? Monocle 24, of course. Coming up next, we're going to be speaking to Sarah McCrory, head of Frieze Project. Okay, you're tuned in to Midori House. We're coming to you live from the Frieze Art Fair. I'm Robert Band. As our second and final show draws to an end, I'm joined now by a lady whose work has become an integral part of the contemporary fair. Sarah McCrory is curator of the Frieze Foundation, whose Frieze projects take pride of place at the top of the tent. To tell us why the curatorial should matter as much as the fiscal, Sarah joins us now. Sarah, thanks for coming on the show.
Hello, thank you.
For rushing through the booths to join us.
Well, you know, anything to be on time-ish.
Also, happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
Chin chin.
We should clink, but it's plastic.
It's a plastic champagne
chink.
Flute. What do you think?
Plop.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
That's refreshing, isn't it?
It's lovely.
Has it been a hard day's night here? Have you been? I know you sort of ran over to us. Is that always what it's like? Are you still full of beans?
Yeah, you know,
That's not a personal question. That is a metaphor about the fair, by the way. That's not. I'm not.
Am I actually full of, I've got terrible wind problem. actually, as it happens, no. I am full of beans. I've worked all year for it,
yeah.
So I'm excited, genuinely. And it's been. There have been more disasters this year than before. But at the same time, again, I think that everything is. You know, again, it's not blowing my own trumpet, but it just seems to be a terrible sense of not knowing when to kind of calm down a bit. Everything's really ambitious. So everything is layered and there's more participants and it's about bigger projects that almost mushroom cloud out across the fair,
yeah.
Which essentially becomes the problem.
But it's lovely that you can be in charge of it and you can enjoy it and you can be the head honcho and you can... Presumably, you can learn from all the things that are going on underneath you, and you've got the experience to do it.
Yeah.
And does the fact that the Frieze Fair is in its 10th year, it's got very solid foundations here in the park, does that help you be a bit more experimental, mess around with stuff, be purely curatorial?
No, I think it becomes harder.
Really?
Yeah, lot harder. I think in the beginning years, the early curators had the luxury of being able to negotiate things which now have been worked into the language of health and safety, food safety, you know, a lot of regulations. And as something becomes an establishment, it becomes harder. So I think it's been a struggle and a fight, and there's been a lot of disappointment, but then some things come through and then maybe that feels better and more exciting. That sounds sort of terribly negative, but I don't mean it's a fight.
I thought you were going to
shed a tear.
I thought you weren't going to shed a tear there. It's all right, you can. We're coming to the end.
We'll do crying hour later. You can just tune in and it'll be me crying for a full hour.
It's a great show, that. Man alive. We can franchise that out across the entire world. That'd be brilliant. And what's going on? The one thing I enjoyed, we sort of scooted around earlier, is the Turkish film, which is called A Murder in Three Parts, I think. That was... Now, I wonder what that is. I didn't know whether it was a film or an installation or somewhere between the two.
Well,
it'd be nice
right
to know
response.
A little bit about that.
Yeah. Well, Aslı Savaşoğlu, who is an emerging Turkish artist from Istanbul, she's a very smart artist. She has been looking at... She's quite interested in TV in general and interested in crime drama, in that she drew this parallel between the detective and the artist. So whilst the whole operation is a full week, well, 3 days of filming and open, almost performatively, so whilst it's a professional crew, TV crew, they're also maybe exaggerating what they do slightly for an audience, which they're not used to, so that's already interesting. But...
And also, it's an interesting thing. It seems to be because we're in an art fair in London. We kind of think, oh, is that what Turkish TV is like? Because we think it might be histrionic. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
is that extra
absolutely.
Element of it feels like it's being doubly acted.
It's drawn from lots of sources. It's drawn from Turkish crime drama, but it's also drawn. Some of the script is from CSI. It's from Morse. It's from the ones that we know really well. But I mean, I think she's interested in that single figure of the detective, who has to take a number of clues and work with what they've got, which is of course a finite amount of information, and produce a result. And she sees that as a parallel with the artist. So, you know, I guess in, you know, when you have Bruce Nauman talking about the artist revealing mystic truths, she's looking at how the detective reveals actual truths and what that means to be an artist. But the other side of that is incredibly performative, fun, and hopefully interesting, because you get to be backstage of a TV drama.
It's an amazingly visual and visceral and totally involving way of kind of putting across that nice idea of exploring mystic truths in a crime drama.
Yeah.
It's quite a veiled way of exploring that notion, I suppose.
I mean, it's a little bit confusing, but I think that's okay.
I think
all the projects have that. I mean, I hope that they're not... I quite like it when someone bobbles over to it and looks confused and sometimes just walks away, and I think this isn't the project for you. You know, it's like this is the projects for the people who have got a bit of time to read the text, and I don't know, people maybe who are more involved in actually unpicking what things are rather than just going to something that's hung on the wall and it being very easy to understand.
I should say for some of our listeners that Frieze Projects, I didn't put this in the preface to our chat this afternoon, Sarah, but the Frieze Projects is the bit that of Frieze that doesn't sell. It is a curatorial idea. It's a kind of gallery show underneath, within the auspices of the Marquee, and that's how it works, isn't it? That's the idea of Frieze Projects.
Exactly, and it is allowed. Well, I guess with some caveats and some difficulties, but it's allowed to critique the market. It's allowed to critique this whole slightly farcical scenario, really.
Are you looking at our studio? You looked at all of us when you said that.
I can't believe this studio.
This is pretty cool.
Was it two iPods and a clip-on mic?
Don't be ridiculous. Don't ruin it for everyone.
I lie. It's a whole setup.
Come on, you twiddle those knobs.
There's 1970s pictures of computers which take up a whole room.
It's the mainframe. It's the mainframe. That's what we are.
I can't remember what I was going to say.
I put myself off. Sorry.
The fair in general is such a... I mean, on one hand, it's just faintly ridiculous. And on the other hand, it's... You know, it's amazing. But we do get a chance to do something that's chaotic and noisy and smelly and messy and complicated. Like Grisdale Arts Project. I don't know if you've seen that yet, but that's all about food and art. So we've had Yang Xiang Group making a Chinese hot pot and then creating calligraphy with the remains. And now William Popel is starting a tomato performance.
Do you know what? We're going to have to leave it there, Sarah. I'm looking at the clock.
On tenterhooks. Maybe people will come and see these things.
Come and see the tomato performance. Sarah McCrory, thank you very much joining us. That was Midori House, live from the Frieze Art Fair. And thank you very much for tuning in. Coming up next, well, today's show, I should probably thank who's been involved in today's show. Today's show is produced by Katie Bilbao. Special thanks to Paul Noble, Jack Phillips, Tom Edwards, and everyone here at the Frieze Art Fair. If you've missed anything, yesterday's and today's show will both be available to download at monocle.com. Via iTunes or on our mobile app. And don't forget to tune in to the special one-year anniversary edition of the Weekly Culture Show on Monday at 1900 hours. Yes, that's right, we're in the army, London time. We'll be reliving some of the highlights from these two action-packed free shows, and we'll have some extra treats in there too. Up next, it's The Entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove, 3 hours' time. That'll be the Monocle Daily at 10 o'clock London time with Andrew Miller and Tom Burgess Watson. For the time being, I've been Robert Band at Frieze. Thank you very much for tuning in.